Welcome to History 605, South Dakota State Historical Society's podcast, where we talk to historians, curators, filmmakers, artists, and authors about how they interpret the past.
10,000 years from now, I think we can meditate and wonder whether our descendants, because I think they'll still be here, what they will think about us. And let us hope that at least they will give us the benefit of the doubt.
I'm Dr. Ben Jones, South Dakota State Historian and Director of the State Historical Society. Join me and our guests as we think historically.
So it is most appropriate and fitting that in our first year of our second century that this should also be a year of reconciliation between the Indian people and the non-Indian people alike.
History 605 is sponsored by the Gruver Family Trust and done in partnership with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Welcome to the show.
Welcome to History 605. Today on the show, we have Peter Cousins. Peter is the author or editor of 18 acclaimed books about the American Civil War and the Indian Wars of the American West. And he's a member of the Advisory Council of the Lincoln Prize. In 2002, he was awarded the American Foreign Service Association's highest honor, the William R. Rifkin Award, given annually for one Foreign Service officer for exemplary moral courage, integrity, and creative dissent. He lives in Kensington, Maryland. Peter, thanks for joining us today on History 605.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I did want to mention a little bit about the Foreign Service experience you have. I served in the Air Force and was in Germany for a tour in the mid-90s and was astonished one time walking into a bookstore in Frankfurt, Germany and seeing all the stuff about Sitting Bull in German by German scholars. It was really amazing. In your postings around the world, how did you find, or did you find that kind of interest was common about the American West?
Not so much about, I spent my 30 years, 19 of my 30 years in Latin America. I was a Latin American. And I didn't find interest in the American West per se that great, but I found interest in American Indians very great.
Yes.
Especially given that all these countries had their own indigenous populations. So there was, and we at the various embassies would arrange events of indigenous peoples in our particular countries with American Indians in the United States, different seminar and fora like that. So there was very strong interest in American Indians. I mean, I found a lot of interest in the West. My book, The Earth is Weeping, has been reprinted in Chinese, Russian, Spanish, Italian, Dutch, and on and on.
Yeah, that book... I read that a few years ago, and it's a very impressive book. I think I highly recommend that. I have in the past friends and people who ask me about American Indian history, and I always recommended that book as something that's worth picking up and reading very closely. So this book, though, on Deadwood, it's very clear that all of your books about the Civil War and American Indians, you've mined a lot of your previous research to kind of put it into together for this and yet still created something that's new. I mean, I haven't read everything that you've written, but this is a very different book than The Earth is Weeping in a lot of ways. What got you interested in writing a book about Deadwood then and the Gold Rush?
Well, I have to be honest, in no small measure, it was the HBO series.
Yeah.
I love that series. And I wanted to really explore the truth behind Deadwood, just out of curiosity myself as to how much of the series was factual and how much of it was either repetition of legends or creation of new legends. Mm-hmm. That was part of it. And also I felt that after Tecumseh and the Prophet and Brutal Reckoning and Earth is Weeping, I'd pretty much exhausted the Indian Wars. And I wanted to stay in the West, so I decided to write about a Western town. And my friend Tom Clavin had already done Tombstone and Dodge City. That combined with my inherent interest in Deadwood. And I was interested in Deadwood also too, a kind of spinoff from The Earth is Weeping, because Deadwood was a proximate cause of the Great Sioux War.
Yeah.
And so I found that angle fascinating too. So all those things drew me to this subject.
Well, and I appreciate too how you can read probably the first three chapters of your book before you really get to Deadwood. I mean, Deadwood isn't around in the first, at the beginning of your book, but it's the, how you pull together the different ideas about monetary policies and Red Cloud's decisions and all these Civil War generals, the politics, 19th century politics, into the story that fosters the creation of what we call Deadwood is kind of necessary antecedents or prehistory to Deadwood, because otherwise you don't know why do a bunch of people start showing up in the summer of 1876 looking for this gold stuff. It needs the backstory, and you do that very well.
Thank you.
I appreciate too how you weave in the not only the Custer expedition, but kind of the economic plight the nation is in. And so what just to briefly let our readers know what's going on in the nation's economy in 1872 and 1873.
Well, in 1873, there was what was called the Panic of 1873. It was one of the greatest economic crises, depressions in American history. It started in Europe with European banks collapsing and gradually found its way across the Atlantic to the United States. And what finally impelled the panic was the collapse of railroad bonds. And that just led to a kind of had a domino effect, and industry shut down. Agriculture was weakened because of decreased demand. Unemployment was vast, and that didn't just last that one year. It was a problem for the better part of the remaining decade. And in 1874, of course, when Custer discovered gold in the Black Hills, the lingering effects of the Panic of 1873 were still very strong. You say high unemployment. Factories shuttered, railroads idle, great destruction of crops from locusts in the Midwest, including South Dakota. Yeah. So the situation was grim economically. Plus, the country had gone back to the gold standard strictly. No longer was bimetallism, but strictly the gold standard. So economic growth, of course, was contingent to a great extent in finding more gold and being able to mint more gold.
Right.
So all these things there's a confluence of these various factors that made the Black Hills gold discovery a lot more, gave it a lot more importance and made it a lot more of a national issue than it might otherwise have been.
Right. What you use the term bimetallism, and you write about that in the book a little bit. What is that?
That's a standard of both silver and gold.
Okay.
Circulation policy is based on the two.
Yeah, so the dollar was then based on gold and silver. But then you explain which was the president who took the silver out of the equation and just based the dollar on gold.
Right.
So then when this economic collapse happens, when we're faced with, we call it a recession of 2008, but panic is probably a better term, I think. When we were faced with that in 2008, 2009, and we had a dollar not based on gold, and we had a Federal Reserve. How did they create more money? I mean, they just created more funds based on a computer program. I think it's difficult for us to kind of realize that the policy of basing your dollar on gold, which has now been gone since the early 70s, is really has implications downstream that we find hard to understand, because our currency is not based on that anymore.
Not tied to anything tangible like it was.
Yes. So when the economy collapses and the dollar is based on gold, all of a sudden gold is the way to put more money in the system. So in a way, it's, and I've explained this to audiences before when talking about the this era and the Black Hills or Deadwood, is that we, meaning the United States government, could create more money by finding more gold. And in 2008, just create more money by computer software programming from the Federal Reserve. So we solve the same problem, but we just have to solve it differently based on the political decisions and the currency and so forth. So, and you explain all of that very well. I think it puts it in its context really quite clearly. So I appreciated that discussion. In fact, I may lift some quotes out of there from time to time to explain that to. What would you say, you mentioned the HBO series, what would you say was you found out from the HBO series that was the truest thing that HBO series got right about Deadwood and the
people? I think they got the atmosphere right. Okay. The HBO series I found to be kind of claustrophobic because everything uh-huh. was happening on Main Street and you had the yeah. false front buildings on either side and all the ox trains and horses crowding the streets and the streets being slop, absolute slop and sludge. They got that right. And
yeah.
the portion of Deadwood that is portrayed in this series is what was called not all of it, but a good part of the series takes place in what was called the Badlands portion of Deadwood, where all the saloons and the prostitution and the gambling carousing went on. And they got that absolutely spot on in every respect, I think.
And you visited Deadwood, you mentioned.
Oh, absolutely, several times.
So how much time have you spent in Deadwood?
In Deadwood itself, you can pretty much see, there's three great museums there, but you can pretty much see everything you want to see in one day. I spent a good deal more time than that because I was doing some digging in the city of Deadwood, I'm sorry, archives, and the archives of Deadwood History Incorporated, which are absolutely fantastic. I mean, they have so much primary source material, not only written material, but also photographs and maps that, I spent a good week in the archives. But then I also spent another 3 to 4 weeks hiking in the Black Hills. I hiked Black Elk Peak.
Good.
I don't know if I do it again, but I hiked Black Elk Peak. I hiked Bear Butte, which is a sacred spot for the Cheyenne. I went to every single stage station site I could find.
Okay.
Stage robbery site, Indian massacre site. I covered the Black Hills, I think, pretty darn well. I saw everything except Mount Rushmore because it was not permanent in the book.
Excellent. Well, yeah. You and as you read this, you can kind of tell that you've captured that too, because I think one of the things that strikes people when they first visit Deadwood is it's, as you termed it, claustrophobia. It's basically in that valley, so tight. And the photos that are in your book, it's a good collection of pictures there because there's several of the Sherman Street or the Main Street and the buildings and just the pell-mell nature of the Wild West. The photos do it a lot of justice too. Who's the first folks in Deadwood then after the economic collapse and all this, the prehistory that's going on, who are the first folks to arrive in Deadwood?
Well, things starts off. You have, of course, Custer discovering gold in the area around Custer City, which is farther south of Deadwood, a good deal south of Deadwood. And then the first gold miners who were able to make it through the military cordon, the Army was trying to cordon off the Black Hills, since it was Lakota treaty land.
Mm-hmm.
The miners who were able to get through, and there were quite a good number of several hundred, naturally congregated around the spot where Custer had discovered gold, around Custer City. The gold in Custer City, there wasn't much of it. It wasn't, after a few months, the miners found that it really wasn't worth the effort. And so miners started drifting north and looking for new diggings. And it was in the first miners to come into Deadwood Gulch came in July 1875. It was a couple guys, Frank Bryant and John Pearson, I think were their names, if I recall correctly. They did a little digging, found some gold, left, came back with some buddies in November 1875. And that's when the first miners came to stay. A handful of miners, they decided to stay and suffer through the winter in Deadwood Gulch all by themselves.
Yeah.
And word got out pretty quickly. And by April 1876, there were several hundred people putting up tents and little brush shanties and whatnot along Deadwood and Whitewood Creeks. And by the summer, by June, there were several hundred, there were at least 200 businesses in Deadwood. False front buildings going up. And it all happened so fast. In fact, one Deadwood resident who was a pioneer and who lived into the 20th century said that he felt like he was living in a motion picture, that 10 years seemed compressed into 1 year, 10 months into 1 month. It just happened so fast.
How would people get there? You mentioned the different kind of routes and the communities in Sioux City, Yankton, and the different, and there's no trains, of course. There's barely a stagecoach or two. How would you go there? And of course, it's illegal for non-Indians to be there. So you'd have to make provisions for that as well.
Right. You had to make provisions for possibly being turned back by the military until early 1876, when the military pretty much, President Grant's order, gave up. In fact, it was earlier than that, late 1875, when the military gave up its efforts to keep miners out of the Black Hills. The most common route was from Cheyenne, but by no means the only route. Cheyenne, Sydney, Sioux City, Bismarck. And the earliest miners either went by oxen train or they walked. Many of them actually walked from Cheyenne, the 275 miles to Deadwood, negotiating both the cordon of the military and also potential Indian raiders. So, but there was strength in numbers. Usually people traveled in caravans, like Wild Bill Hickok and his buddy Colorado Charlie Utter went to the Black Hills in July 1876 in a pretty good sized caravan. And that was the safest way. It was slow. It was slow going. And it wasn't until Deadwood was relatively well settled in the autumn of 1876 that the first stagecoach rolled into town.
Well, you mentioned it, Wild Bill Hickok. It's certainly a book filled with grand and fascinating personalities. Some of whom are portrayed in the HBO series, but was there somebody you ran across in this, in doing the research, that you hadn't heard of before that you thought was just as compelling a character as Hickok or Calamity Jane?
Not so much that I hadn't heard of, but I covered all the characters quite, I hope, well, who are in Deadwood: Sol Star, Seth Bullock, E.B. Farnham, Al Merrick, Jack Langreish. And the series did a good job of picking out the most important characters in Deadwood. There were others like the businessman J.P.K. Miller, and there were various madams and prostitutes who were well-known or infamous, I would say, in Deadwood, who might not have been portrayed in the series. But some of the characters were based on these folks. So it was more of a case of rediscovering some of these characters from the series and learning about their real life story, which I thought was more compelling than what was in Deadwood, for instance. I think a prime example of that is Al Swearengen, the pimp and saloon owner that Ian McEwan played. Swearengen, at least in the series, he had a few redeeming qualities from time to time, but he had no redeeming qualities whatsoever.
Right.
He was married, and he even had his wife procuring for him. And when she didn't do her job well enough, he beat her. I mean, he had nothing. Yeah. The only thing he ever did that was not selfish, I think I mentioned in the book, is he served for 1 year in an Iowa volunteer regiment in the Civil War, and that was it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was it.
Yeah, I think that's always the kind of the pre-story with a lot of the characters in the West, is where they served in the Civil War. And you always wonder, and it's very difficult to kind of prove this unless they've left letters or something behind, but the impact of what their war service meant.
And you see how many, if you go to Mount Moriah Cemetery, obviously you want to look at Calamity Jane and Wild Bill's graves. And, but if you look more closely through the cemetery, you'll see a lot of markers, the same things you'd find in a national park cemetery, markers of veterans who died in Deadwood from various Union regiments. There were also a lot of ex-Confederates who drifted into Deadwood. But a tremendous number of Union and Confederate veterans found their way into Deadwood.
Yeah, well, I did not know that Swearengen was in an Iowa unit. So that's an interesting thing to run down, dig deeper in. And Chinatown, which recently the descendant of one of the primary Chinatown leaders in Deadwoods, they just had a family reunion in debt with this summer. Longfili, his three, I guess he had five or six children, and they were able to bring back descendants of three of those branches of those kids. Had a family reunion at Deadwood in July. So, yeah, the governor had a proclamation. They unveiled a statue, so there's a statue of him there now in Chinatown, and it's really great to see how Deadwood, as a community, has embraced that Chinatown heritage as part of their history.
And they embraced Chinatown. It's relatively speaking, contemporaneous views on the Chinese and on racial policy, Deadwood was a pretty welcoming place for the Chinese, where they were being expelled from other communities in the West, and there were call for this out-and-out expulsion of all Chinese, and violence against Chinese was not uncommon. Chinese were not allowed to own property. They were allowed to own property in Deadwood, and their rights were protected by the legal system in Deadwood. And incidents of violence against the Chinese was punished by Deadwood courts. I found that really kind of uplifting, to tell you the truth.
Yeah. Another thing that's prompted a lot of curiosity, and I don't know if he was in the Saul Star. Was he in the HBO?
Yes, he was. Real prominent. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the Saul Star for real life is just a fascinating guy. And here's a Jewish American in Deadwood, in a state that has next to zero Jewish people.
German Jewish immigrant, as a matter of fact, right?
Yes. And he becomes a member of the state legislature, but this long time serving mayor and commercial leader and business leader in Deadwood. In your estimation, how does that translate into what the Wall Street Journal mentioned about your book, too, was that Deadwood is probably one of the better places to live in the 1870s and 1880s in America, just due to the desire to get along.
That plus it's really surprising how quickly Deadwood, the merchants in Deadwood, and given the difficulties of getting merchandise into the Black Hills, again, by ox train for the most part, by 1878, 79, you could pretty much get anything you wanted for your home in Deadwood that you'd find in a well-established Midwestern town. And by 1870, I don't want to get the year wrong, 78 or 79, I can't recall, there were telephones in Deadwood. In the early 1880s, Deadwood had electricity far earlier than many towns back east. So it was a real, as rough and rowdy and raucous as it was also pretty progressive.
Well, it was bringing in technology and so forth and the connection, and certainly the gold would draw a lot of interest from around the world, and your intermittent throughout the book is George Hearst and kind of what's going on down the road in Lead with the mine there. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could just explain for the listeners briefly, what's the difference between placer mining and then this hard rock mining or deep mining?
Placer mining is the mining of either surface gold or gold that is pretty close to the surface, kind of gold that's run off and eroded from quartz veins, which are gold adheres to quartz, among other things, but quartz principally. And the quartz veins, you can identify them at the surface generally, but they go deep into the ground. And placer mining requires very little to no capital, especially in its inception. I mean, the first placer miners just went in with pans and rockers and what were called long toms, which looked like long cradles. And with that, they were able to extract large quantities of surface gold from streams, stream beds, surface, or just a few, few feet down in ravines and whatnot. But that gold pretty much ran out by the end of 1879. And by then, deep mining and the quartz mining was taking hold. And it became evident that if Deadwood was going to survive and prosper, that it had to encourage the kind of capital and investment that was needed to make possible this deep mining. And that's where George Hearst comes into the picture. He was already a multimillionaire This is George Hearst, the father of William Randolph Hearst. He was already a multimillionaire from other mining ventures, and he came into Lead, which is the neighboring town to Deadwood, and where a lot of the placer mines, the better placer mines, were. And he began buying them up and establishing one great mine called the Homestead Mine that eventually just took over and became the principal source of gold into the 20th century.
I mean, he comes from, well, he'd been operating mines or running mines in California, Colorado, gold and silver mines. And
Nevada.
So, Nevada, yes. All places that gaining lots of experience, and then was able to, with his financial resources and his pool of talent in mining, kind of exploit what was available in Lead and develop it into this, I think it's the second most productive gold mine in North America. That's what is often said.
Yeah, I read that it was the most productive in the United States. I don't know if there was Canada that was more productive, but
yeah,
certainly one or two. Yeah,
right. But the placer mining is kind of what all of the folks kind of thrown out of work from the panic of 1873. That's kind of what brings them. But as you talk about with Hearst and these others, the long-term mining that's going to occur is going to be with this, these deep mines.
The placer mine kind of coincided with the wild times in Deadwood that we all associate with the town. And they kind of played off one another, really.
What's fun is with your book too, is reading it along. And the next thing you know, you've introduced a character you hadn't necessarily thought you'd see, like Theodore Roosevelt and so forth. Seth Bullock has a interesting relationship with Roosevelt. And I was not surprised, but it was fascinating to read how when Roosevelt dies in 1919, that Bullock is crushed. And he works very hard to get that monument, Mount Roosevelt named, and the monument there that's near Deadwood up and done, and to commemorate his friend and former American president.
I was fortunate, speaking of Seth Bullock, I was fortunate to come across the Seth Bullock papers. His papers were acquired by Yale University just before the pandemic. And they got about 80% of them. The remaining 20-25% were subsequently acquired by the city of Deadwood, their archives. And so I was able to obviously to use both. And I was the first person, as far as I know, to avail himself of the Seth Bullock papers. And they were tremendous. It was his personal correspondence with Sal Starr, with others back east, his official correspondence as sheriff, and then a lot of correspondence with Kermit Roosevelt and others after Teddy died, encouraging Seth Bullock in his efforts to, you know, name Mount Roosevelt to put up a statue in honor of Teddy. And it's like Kermit, Roosevelt, and others really, they didn't have to put pressure on Seth Bullock. He was more than willing to do it. Yeah. But they really looked to him strongly for this. And there was a lot of correspondence between the men.
Well, and that was one thing. I'd followed the Roosevelt family for a long time as my career as a historian. And I had never known that Kermit was sent out to take writing lessons and hunting lessons with Seth Bullock by his dad. That was an interesting angle that was new to me, too. So, and it tells you that, you know, sometimes you're told that so-and-so is friends with so-and-so, you know, like, oh, Seth Bullock and Roosevelt were friends. And you think, well, just how much truth is to that? But clearly in this case, I mean, if you're sending your son off to learn something from a man, it's probably because you think well of him. So that was a reinforcing notion.
Right. They were close.
Yeah.
In fact, Seth Bullock, just kind of an aside, if you were to ask me who my favorite character was in Deadwood, it would be Seth Bullock.
Okay.
He was a real stand-up guy, even more so than portrayed in the HBO series. Portrayed as having had an affair with a woman, long-term affair in the series. He didn't. He was very faithful to his wife. Yeah. They were sweethearts from their teen years. And Martha Bullock, when she came to Deadwood, was a very dynamic presence in Deadwood in and of herself. But without a doubt, Seth Bullock's my favorite character. He was something of an eccentric too. Had a huge pack of dogs, that he kept in the store. And
okay.
was quite a character.
The that exchange when he first meets Roosevelt, I thought was hilarious. And I'm trying to find the quote here, you may recall it faster than I can find it, but when Roosevelt is going around as kind of like trying to clean up the civil service in the territory, and Bullock says, yeah, I'm all for good civic service. I can get behind that, or has some phrase
something to the effect that he was on his ranch when he saw Roosevelt and a couple of Roosevelt's, you know, compatriots in this endeavor riding up, and they were pretty trail worn, dusty and dirty. And Bullock at first is wondering, are these guys, you know, what are they? I mean, are these troublemakers, road agents, what are they? And so he asks Roosevelt what he's up to. And Roosevelt said, well, I'm on civil service business. And Bullock allegedly said, well, anything civil is fine with me.
Yeah. Right. When you're the sheriff, that's a good thing to say. Yeah. The other thing that I found interesting there, in going back to kind of the beginning of the book and the setup, is that the Army's been ordered by Grant to keep miners and settlers out of the hills due to the treaty requirements, but it's not working. Red Cloud and Spotted Tail go to Washington, and Grant more or less sits them down and has to tell them the way it is, because even he can't keep people out anymore. But prior to that, Sherman and Sheridan had been trying to move heaven and earth to do just that. And the Gordon Party and all these people just keep showing up and evading their efforts. And when you realize that in 1865, the United States Army had hundreds of thousands of soldiers, but then in 1866, Congress shrinks it to 25,000. And do Reconstruction.
Right.
And protect the wagon trains and do all this stuff, that pretty soon there's maybe just a couple companies of guys that are available to go in and out of the Red Hill, Black Hills, and keep miners out. That the frustration that Grant must have felt must have been palpable. How did you kind of, you describe a meeting in November of 1875 that I thought was interesting and very illuminating about the just the position that Grant is in and Sherman is in, and wanting to honor the treaty, but not being able to. How did you kind of navigate all this? And as a person in the diplomatic service, could you kind of see yourself having similar kind of, how do I explain this reality?
Well, I actually wrote an article too that people can access online about that.
Okay.
In magazine a number of years ago about that conference in November 1875, that Grant essentially, he was faced with, okay, do all I can to honor the treaty, or do I give in to my constituents? Even though he wasn't running for another term, that the hue and cry was open the Black Hills, open the Black Hills. Let's get the gold. Let's get moving with this. To hell with the treaties and the Indians. He was forced to choose between the two, and he came down on the side of let's open the Black Hills by hook or by any way we can. I mean, he tried to purchase the Black Hills from the Lakota, the reservation Lakota. They wouldn't sell, at least not for the price the government was offering. And in part also because the non-reservation Lakota, like the bands of Sitting Bull and Crazy, were opposed to this and threatened the reservation chiefs that if they acceded to the government's wishes, they would suffer themselves. And so everything was stalemated. And in November 1875, Grant decided on war, on provoking the Lakota to war, provoking the non-reservation Lakota to war, and defeat them. And then the reservation chiefs would fall into line and be willing to sell the Black Hills for whatever the government was willing to offer. So he and Secretary of the Interior, Secretary of War, Sherman, George Crook. Sheridan. Actually, Sherman was left out of this conference because Grant feared that Sherman had too many scruples for this, what he was planning.
Okay.
It was Crook, Grant, Sheridan, and the secretaries I mentioned. They hatched a plan to provoke war with Lakota by demanding that the non-reservation Lakota report to the reservations in the dead of winter, or else be considered hostile. And it was an impossible demand to be met with. And it was intended to command that was intended to fail to justify the war. So the Black Hills were the direct, were the proximate cause of the Great Sioux War, and Deadwood, being the principal community in the Black Hills, was part of that proximate cause,
right,
of the Sioux War, which ended the, effectively ended the Lakota way of life.
Well, it raises an interesting question. Do you think President Grant knew that he was playing some Indians off against the other, Sitting Bull off against Red Cloud?
Absolutely. And I found evidence of this in papers in the that had been that were stashed away in the Library of Congress and the National Archives, correspondence between Sheridan and Crook, especially between those two, subsequent to the meeting, where they said, we're saying to one another, well, you know, President Grant's made it pretty clear what we need to do here.
Right, and
there was nothing ambiguous about it at all on Grant's part.
Okay.
It was a direct violation of his own peace policy.
Yeah. Right, right.
Remarkably, Grant biographers had generally overlooked this very portentous meeting. They did rather just focus on his peace policy than this egregious breach of the peace policy.
Well, I would agree with you there. I think in the biographies about Grant, this late 1875 time frame doesn't get a lot of attention. And so it's kind of a black hole. And if you read a biography about Grant, and whether the biographer is kind or beating him up for other things, it's kind of difficult to piece together what's going on. So there is a descendant of Spotted Tail that I've met here in South Dakota, and he has the Peace Medal that Grant gave Spotted Tail. He still has that same Peace Medal, and it is in fine shape. So, and he wears it proudly from time to time at the appropriate occasion. He'll have that on. And I saw him across a museum gallery where we were exhibit on, and thought, oh, that's a Peace Medal. It's got to be a reproduction. And I walked up to him and asked him, you know, how did he come by that? And he said, well, I inherited it. Oh. So then he tells me the story about his fifth great grandfather, Spotted Tail, who was given it to him by Grant. So it's always very rewarding to see the physical thing, like an artifact like that.
Absolutely.
About conversations that you read about in books or in dusty archives and so forth. I was wondering too, about sources. You mentioned a few of them, and that's quite amazing that you're the first to kind of be able to use those sources at Yale and Deadwood about Seth Bullock. That's great. Are there other sources that you're able to mine for this?
I'd say if you go through my notes, about 50% of the sources that I used were newspapers, either newspapers that were published in Deadwood, like the Black Hills Time, the Pioneer, or the Daily Champion. I read every issue of all three newspapers.
Okay.
Time frame that I was writing about.
Yeah.
And which really, I mean, the story was developing in almost like in real time.
Right.
As I was reading these papers, not only the Deadwood papers, but also newspapers from across the country, to see how Deadwood and the Black Hills were perceived outside of the Black Hills. And also a lot of these transplants to Deadwood wrote letters to their hometown newspapers or letters to family, which were then published in hometown newspapers all over the country. And proved an absolute goldmine, so to speak, of material. So my research was heavily anchored in contemporaneous newspapers.
Well, and it's that, I'm glad you brought that up, because I've been interested too in Preacher Smith. He's not a young man, a Civil War veteran, but he takes a very different tack on life than Al Swearingen does, and he winds up in Deadwood working, but also attempting to start a church. And his murder is often discussed in the history of Deadwood, but I think yours was the first book that came through so conclusively that he was probably murdered by Oglala or Indians that were.
There's absolutely no doubt whatsoever in my mind, none at all, that he was killed by Lakota. The evidence overwhelmingly points to that.
Mm-hmm.
First and foremost, who would want to kill? I mean, who in Deadwood or surrounding environment, what non-Indian would have any reason whatsoever to kill Preacher Smith? He wasn't carrying a lot of money or anything like that.
Yeah.
I mean, he was universally liked. And at that, he was warned not to go. He was Right. It was a Sunday, and he wanted to go to Crook City, which is about a, it was about 15 mile walk, I think, 15 miles. 12. It's a healthy walk. He wanted to go to Crook City and preach that day. And he was warned by everyone he came into contact with in Deadwood not to go, because it was well established that Indian raiders were on the road between Deadwood and Crook City. And there'd already been some miners who'd been fired upon by the Indians. There was a miner killed that very same day, not too far where Preacher Smith was killed. I mean, within almost, I think, rifle shot hearing distance. Crazy Horse was in the Black Hills with a small band of warriors. They were there. I mean, they were on those trails. And again, there's no one else would have any reason whatsoever to kill Preacher Smith. The fact that he wasn't, some people say, well, he wasn't scalped, so that's, you know, proves that it wasn't an Indian. Well, Crazy Horse never took scalps.
Yeah.
And I think his warriors, a lot of his warriors followed his lead and didn't take scalps. So that proves absolutely nothing whatsoever.
Well, it was pretty, I don't know if you had a good defense attorney, if that would hold up in court or not, but it is a pretty good argument, I think, that and that nothing was taken off the body afterward either. He wasn't robbed or
no.
What do you think late 19th century Deadwood says to America today? I mean, we have the television series, we have thousands of people go to Deadwood every year to visit this. What is the prompt of the fascination, and what can it tell us about our past?
I think it's a microcosm of the West and the very best and the very worst of the American character. I mean, it's a prime example of, you know, here you have this town that's intrinsically lawless. I mean, not just lawless in the behavior, like in, say, Tombstone or Dodge City, but is a lawless enterprise in and of itself. It was, it was not subject to any federal or territorial laws for the first 10 months or so of its existence. And greed and avarice just ran wild. And it's a really good example of what people will do when there are no constraints to rein in their avarice or their greed, except what they themselves will construct. And so it's interesting study in that respect, how people behave under those circumstances, and also how they do try to create a society themselves, how they try to create law and order in spite of all this. You know, the tension of the faction that's just there to make a quick buck and a quick killing, and others like Seth Bullock and Sol Starr, who want to make this an ongoing enterprise, the tension between these elements. I mean, it's the American story in a microcosm, really. Right.
Yeah, and the whole genre of the Western movie, that very thing that you just described very ably is summed up in a lot of Western movies about that.
Right, everything between. From Liberty Vance to High Noon to...
Exactly. Yep. Liberty Vance, one of my favorite movies of all time. That's a super, super great film. Well, Peter, what's next?
My editor wanted me to stay out west. I wanted to stay out west, so I'm working on a book on Virginia City and the Comstock Lode.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you got to Deadwood first. I did kind of chuckle, too, about the complaint about people in Montana losing population to Deadwood and Dakota Territory. And
so, newspaper editor, where is he from? Is he from Billings or Bozeman? I forget to say. Don't go to the Black Hills. You know, apply yourself here in Montana Territory. And there's plenty of ways to make money here and things you can contribute to Montana society. Don't run off to the Black Hills. You're just going to be a losing proposition, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. Well, good luck with that book. And again, I highly recommend this one to all the readers. And we've been speaking today to Peter Cousins, author of Deadwood, Gold, Guns, and Greed in the American West. Thanks a lot for listening.
We'd like to thank Howard and Dorothy Gruver for their passion for history and the support of the South Dakota State Historical Society. It's through gifts such as theirs that we're able to tell South Dakota's history.
When a tornado hits a town, I've never been able to figure out which houses were the Democrats, or the Republicans, or the Libertarians. I never knew who the Norwegians were, the Swedes. are the Czechoslovakians or the Germans? Of course, everybody wants to point out who the Irish are, but other than that...
History 605 is produced by the South Dakota State Historical Society, and its audio engineer is the amazing Kevin Larson. We'd like to thank our partner, South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and most importantly, we'd like to thank you for listening. Please rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to fine podcasts. We'll be back in a couple weeks with another episode of History 605.